The government has unveiled its plans to help the economy get through the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and what it's doing around the country. The headline is that it's big and it's only the beginning. Businesses will receive the lion's share of the $12.1 billion rescue package, while beneficiaries and superannuitants will also get a cash bonus with a permanent increase to main benefit rates. There will be $5.1 billion given to affected businesses for wage subsidies in all sectors and all regions. $126 million will be available to employers to pay for workers who are self-isolating, have COVID-19 or are looking after a family member with COVID-19. All of the measures in today's package will take effect immediately with payments coming in the next 5 days. So, to go over what's been released and what it will mean short term, we are joined by New Zealand Initiative Chief Economist Dr. Eric Crampton. Good afternoon, Eric.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us. Jacinda Ardern said in Parliament just after the announcement that the government has gone hard with today's package. Has it gone hard enough?
This is a great start. I think we need to leave some room for potential things yet to come, but this is hitting the right notes right at the start. So the first priority in any pandemic would have to be health issues. They do have some substantial increases for the Ministry of Health and the DHBs for looking at what they're going to be needing for increasing capabilities, for increasing capacity for testing, for augmenting the ICUs and capability for dealing with the surge that could yet come through. We should also think, though, of some of the support that's been characterized as support for business is actually part of the support for health. So if we're looking at payments to employers and employees around self-isolation, that's the kind of thing that I've been wanting for at least the past month and a half. Singapore has had this in place for a long time, where if they've had a worker who's required to be on self-isolation because they've been coming back from Wuhan, or they've been in contact with somebody who's a case, or they've got one or two symptoms and they need to be watching things, the employer gets a fixed payment per day that the employee is on self-isolation, so long as they keep paying that worker.
So how much is that payment?
In Singapore, it's $100 Singaporean per day.
Here,
it's going to be substantially more than that. Mm. So it's looking at $585 per week. Great. For full-time workers. So a little bit more. What that does, though, is it changes the incentives. The last thing that you want is somebody in a pandemic rocking up to work because they can't afford not to. That they should be staying home sick, but if they run out of sick leave and there is a small employer who's taking a massive hit anyway because of reduced demand, they might not be able to afford to provide that support. This measure helps to encourage people to do the right thing and stay home when they're sick and should be in isolation. I very strongly support that.
And there was an example given with the package today which was interesting. They talked about John Smith, a plumber working, arriving back from a holiday in Sydney. Despite feeling well, the government's self-isolation restrictions meant John had to self-isolate for 14 days. He'd already used his mandatory sick days earlier this year. The employer was not able to cover his wage for 14 days while he's off work. His employer applies to MSD and they get a lump sum to pass on to John for his 2 weeks in self-isolation. So just to give an example to people watching.
Yep. And the really nice bit that they've also got in there is a guard against what you might call self-inflicted wounds. So it might be tempting to consider yourself as being eligible for a really extended holiday, right? If you go and take that trip out to the islands and then some of the quarantine restrictions change and you come back, you get an extra 2 weeks leave. Nuh-uh. You're only able to access it if you've traveled overseas earlier. You can't get it for these future trips you might take.
Right. So let's break down the wage subsidies too, which is the other big part of this. Billions of dollars for that. What makes you eligible for a wage subsidy?
You'd have to be working for a smaller employer or one who's got very few employees who are going to be taking this up. So the maximum amount for any one employer is $150,000. So that works out to being something like 20 full-time employees in total that could be covered by it. But what it will do is provide some support to help employers avoid having to lay people off. So they'll have to be able to declare that they're going to be able to keep employing affected individuals at least 80% of their income over the duration, and they have to jump a bit of a hurdle with their bank to show that their earnings have actually gone down sufficiently, so the employer has to be facing a bit of hardship to have eligibility here.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Employers must have suffered or are projected to suffer at least a 30% decline in revenue compared to last year.
So, Peter Dunn here, where does this leave self-employed people?
you would hope that they would count similarly under this one, that if you can go into zero as a self-employed worker and show that your revenues month to month have the appropriate hit. I didn't see anything in here that would disallow those self-employed employees.
Because right. that's a really good point, Peter. 70% of New Zealand businesses have no employees, right? So are sole traders. So what does this mean for them, Eric? Let's go into that a little bit.
Well, we'd have to see the detail because we've got a one-page fact sheet here, and they've got examples of non-self-employed people. But if you are an owner-employer firm, so a sole proprietorship that you only employ yourself, you as employer would have to show that this is my interpretation from the fairly brief fact
Understood.
Sheet given out.
Mm.
As on the employer side, you would have to be showing that your earnings have gone down sufficiently, and you'd have to be committing that you're going to be keeping yourself on as employee for that 80%, and then you'd be eligible.
Right. Can I just interrupt you? I was listening to Grant Robertson in Parliament, and he did say that this would encourage the self-employed to stay at home if need be.
That would be on the COVID self-isolation regime.
And what about the other end of the scale, Eric? The release talks about this. The package was mostly focused at they're talking about smaller and medium businesses. They say that there will be tailor-made solutions for big business that they can't. That a lot of this package isn't aimed at people who are working for big business yet. So what does that mean?
Well, we haven't seen that yet. So the wage subsidy scheme again is only up to a maximum of $150,000 for any one employer.
Yeah.
We're talking about 10,000 layoffs coming at Air New Zealand. Either we're talking about a lot of people very suddenly being on benefit or a different package that's yet to be announced.
Right. So I'm just trying to anticipate that people at home listening to this, there'll be a lot of those sole traders out there, but there'll also a lot of people who, you know, most New Zealanders work for big businesses. So they're not necessarily, if they get sick, they'll be covered, but there's only up to that $150,000 cap, right?
So, yeah, the $150,000 cap is the total amount that a business can claim on the wage subsidy scheme. On the COVID leave, that's a little bit different. It doesn't really matter whether you're with a big firm or a small firm, right, or if you're self-employed, you should be having access to that for up to the $585 per week if you're a full-time worker.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. How does this compare with other countries around the world?
Well, we've seen some pretty big fiscal response in the United States, but not targeted in this way as yet. There, of course, the Federal Reserve went down to pretty close to zero and has engaged in substantive quantitative easing. We still have provision for doing that here, but they've just opened up the facility for the Reserve Bank to be purchasing government debt if it comes to that. We perhaps need to be thinking about that come the next budget. So there is potential for that. There will be substantial increases in the amount the government's having to spend through its automatic stabilizers on benefits and that kind of social support at the same time as a massive hit to the health system. I would hope that the health system is expecting a bit of an open checkbook on dealing with some of the pandemic, that we shouldn't be nickel and diming ventilators and respirators and getting those going.
Well, can I ask Peter on that, $500 million for the health, am I right, $500 million for health, is that enough?
Well, it's hard to say because it's not clear where it's going to be spent. But I give you just a for instance, the issue that was referred to in the news about the flu test, the flu vaccination now being made available for older people ahead of what was originally scheduled is a good example. You know, have we got enough stock on hand now to medicate the population that we need? Do we need to be forward ordering more? How's that going to be funded, etc.? So $500 million seems a lot, but I suspect when you start to break down where it's going to go, that may need to be one area that'll have to be topped up.
Lots of areas we might need to be expanding in thinking about the surge that could yet hit the health system. Our ICUs are nowhere near capable of dealing with what could be coming. Ashley Bloomfield today was talking about potential expansion into some of the recovery wards where they do have access to ventilators and making those be part of the potential COVID response. I don't know what facilities they're going to have in place for once people are ready to leave those but still need a bit of support and care and potentially still need a bit of ventilation. there'll be other facilities that they'll be purpose building for this, if they'll be taking up other buildings that are available and moving kit into them. If we are hitting global supply shortages on things like ventilators and respirators and sort of the artificial lung machines that we only seem to have, I think, up in Auckland, are there facilities for talking with New Zealand manufacturers to get some of these going? The ventilators that were in place 20 years ago might not be as fancy as the ones we have now, but it would be better than nothing. Nothing is the alternative in Italy currently when they've run out of capacity. And things that are 20 years old are outside of patent. So it would be pretty easy to encourage a bit of fabrication to go on here.
Eric, as an economist, do you look at today's package and say, this will take off the rough edges, to use a phrase from the GFC? Will this be enough to smooth off some of those rough edges?
There's not going to be anything the government can do to stop all of the rough edges that are going to be coming. We're facing a global tsunami on this one. The first priority is making sure that we get the health system in as tooled up as it can be to deal with the mess. And for that, it should be dealing with like pretty close to an open checkbook. These are the kind of thing that we should be able to borrow for, and it's the point of having fiscal responsibility that we're able to issue debt to deal with this kind of thing.
So can I ask you both, 19.5% is our debt-to-GDP ratio at the moment. Obviously, the government has been making big mention of that today to say, look how responsible we've been. We are in a great position to deal with the rainy day because of the savings that have been made. Where do you expect that target to the new target for our debt levels? How high do you think we are likely to need to go?
I think we should maintain a long-term debt target of 20%, but worry less about what the costs will be of the current crisis. It'll be after this, making sure that the measures put in are temporary, that they can be scaled back. We might need to have a permanent increased health system capability if COVID is likely to be with us for several years. So that part of that might not be temporary, but we should be focused on being able to get back to that debt path after this is done.
Right. Peter, how high do you think?
No, I think Eric's right. I think that if you strike a long-term average of around 20%, you've got a bit of room either side. We're on the slightly low side at the moment, so we've got a bit of scope. I think we probably could go 2 or 3 points higher and still be on the long-term track. I think the important thing here is that we've got that built-in capacity. And, of course, you know, during the hard years when governments were reducing our debt levels, there was a lot of criticism about why aren't you investing more in the economy and other areas, et cetera, et cetera. This is a very good answer to that question as to why not. Now, when we need it, we actually have the capacity to spend a little bit more to keep people in jobs, to keep people with a reasonable standard of living, and to enable us to sort of have a fair crack at getting through this.
Half of that $12 billion is going to be spent this year, but half of it is over the next 4 years. I'm interested in what you guys make of that. Is there politics in there as well, Peter? I noticed that the welfare benefits, and look, on any other day, this would be huge news, right? A $25 a week increase in benefits.
There's very definitely politics in there. I think that they were planning to increase benefits in the May budget. The Greens have been making a lot of noise in that respect. And I think what they've done now by bringing this forward is two things. Firstly, give the Greens a win, which is probably secondary in this environment. But secondly, I think they're committing that money now because even the rate things are going, by the time we get to the May budget, there may be other priorities that might have made it more difficult to do so. So I think there's a lot of politics in that. Bear in mind, we still have a certain event in September that they, through all this, have got to keep their eye on trying to win. So, you know, that's that aspect. I think also...
Well, let me ask you just briefly on that, and I'll ask Alexia too. Do you think this is an election-winning, and I know this is not the first priority, people, you know, I don't mean to trivialise this in any regard, but as you say, there is an election coming, and all of these decisions have a political element to them. Do you think this is an election-winning decision today, announcement today?
I don't think it's an election losing one either. I think that Eric made the point before, which I think is quite valid, that you can never do enough in these circumstances. Whatever the government does, there'll be someone who'll be adversely affected. And I think the government's challenge is not so much what it throws out there, but how it mitigates those adverse effects, those pinch points that won't become obvious immediately. So I think the best it can hope for is that this is neutral. If it gets out there as being, you know, too many pinch points, then they've got a political problem. But if you look at other crises, there tends to be a surge of initial support for what they've done, and then over time it pales away. And I think this is the same pattern here, and they've just got to hope that the line don't cross over before the election.
I think in terms of optics, they're looking very good for Ardern, who has now looked like she has handled three or four crises in a row with absolute aplomb. And I think that Bridges whinging after this in Parliament has looked very petty and small. Whether or not that continues through to September the 19th or whenever a new election date might be, if they push it out, is another question. But at the moment, I think it's looking very good in terms of statesmanship for Labor.
The test has been with this government and will be delivery, right? And actually to see, make sure these plans roll out as they should. That's often be the worry word for Labor is delivery, right?
Yes, it is. But I think this is actually bigger than that. If you just give you a couple of quick examples.
Yeah.
At the time of the first Christchurch earthquake, Bob Parker was trailing Jim Anderton massively in the polls. The way he reacted immediately got him a landslide victory in 2010. But the moment he was re-elected and the next wave of earthquakes came, his popularity plummeted steadily over the 3 years to the extent that he didn't even run again in 2013.
Yeah.
Go back to March 15 last year, Prime Minister's popularity surged after her performance around those events. By year's end, her party's trailing in the opinion polls. My point is that these things have that natural pattern to them. Whatever you do, I'm not being critical of the government, I'm just saying whatever you do, because pinch points start to emerge. So their challenge is to try and make sure that they can, if you like, stay above the line until September in that respect. And who knows?
Eric, before you go, do you think this... He's gone. We've lost. Eric has gone. Eric, let me say in absentia, thank you very much for your time today. Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative.